Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here, joined by Shad Markowitz. We are your co-hosts for this weekend's edition. Also your host throughout the week, as we are continuing to produce a lot of content focused on the metals, but then also ranging to, well, U.S. equity markets, the dollar currencies, as well as some cryptocurrency comments. Please keep all the emails coming. We love hearing from each and every one of you, and please go back through the week on our website, kereport.com, and listen to a lot of those company updates. We love hearing your feedback on the companies we're bringing on, either positive or negative on those companies. We learn a lot from each and every one of you. On this weekend show, we're going to really take a big picture look at markets, metals, and some of the other key sectors that we think everyone should be noting. We are kicking off the show with Mike Larson. He is the editor of the Safe Money Report. You can also follow Mike on Twitter at RealMikeLarson. Now, Mike, starting off with the U.S. equity markets. We are recording this quite late in the day on Wednesday, so we don't know where these markets are going to close, but we can already make the comment that this week has been volatile for the markets. Just on Wednesday today, the markets were down a little over 1% and then have recovered to positive territory. And if you go back just to the beginning of September, we have seen a general pullback in the U.S. equity markets. The S&P is down about 5 to 6%. The tech stocks, those are pulling back even more. Mike, what do you take away from this volatility we're seeing that started in September?
Yeah, we're in this pattern where we have a lot of just people running from one side of the boat to the other on any given day, right? I mean, you know, you're up 400 or 500 points in the Dow one day, you're down 300 or 400 points the next, and sometimes even intraday, you're swinging around by multiple hundreds of points. I think people are trying to suss out whether a couple of things are going to be worked out. In the first case, of course, there's the ongoing debate about the U.S. debt ceiling. You know, we seem to have this thing happen every, I don't know how many months, sometimes a year or two, depending on how fast the debt's rising. We get down to this thing where, you know, you get to a game of chicken where the Republicans say one thing, the Democrats say another, and they say that they're not going to come to a deal. Then the markets throw a hissy fit, and voila, they come to a deal because nobody wants their account sizes to get any smaller, including the people in charge of Congress. So, you know, it goes down to the wire, but they tend to work something out. And yet it still creates market volatility. So that's one force we've got acting out here right now. Obviously, the issues in China and what's going to happen with this kind of Evergrande saga, you know, is this real estate developer going to run into real trouble? I mean, it's already defaulted on a couple of bonds. Is that going to snowball, create more widespread losses? You know, what does that say about the strength of the Chinese economy and real estate being such a huge driver over there? Obviously, everything from, you know, governments making huge money from land sales. That's how they get a lot of revenue as opposed to taxes. They also, of course, building these, you know, multi-story buildings in the middle of nowhere by the dozens, by the you know, hundreds, whatever the numbers are. You know, that creates a lot of demand for everything from employment to commodities, things that go into those buildings. If that's going to start to slow down because China's cracking down, what does that mean for the commodities and sort of, you know, resources side of the business and the markets? And also, you just have questions about what's happening with liquidity. The Federal Reserve starting to take tentative baby steps towards draining some liquidity, you know, maybe tapering bond buying and then eventually raising rates. People are concerned about that because there's a possibility that happens before the end of the year. At least the decision to actually do that, and then the unwinding begins, whatever, December or early next year. If that happens, I mean, it ends this sort of never-ending money pump into the market. So that's another factor that's driving it. It also tends to be, you know, any talk about draining dollar liquidity, excess liquidity, makes the dollar a little more valuable, a little more scarce. So you're seeing the dollar rise in value here. And that's also, again, tends to be a negative for particular sectors, things like commodities. And of course, as you mentioned, technology, which was a key driver of the market and is highly overweighted in things like the S&P 500, the benchmark, you know, the top five U.S. tech stocks, these multi-trillion dollar tech stocks, have a very large weighting in the S&P. So when tech pulls back, it drags the broader averages down as well. And tech is particularly vulnerable to any thought of interest rates rising down the road. It just sort of results in the future cash flows being discounted back at a, you know, making them have a lower value in the here and now. So long story short, all those factors, interest rates, concern about China and the real estate situation over there, plus a rising dollar, plus uncertainty about the debt ceiling, all that thrown into the soup is what's behind this correction. So I think a lot of things are going to have to work themselves out in the next few weeks before people have the confidence to say, you know what, it's been a great year. Instead of taking some chips off the table, I'm going to try and see if I can tack on a few more points by December 31st. For people to be willing to do that, they're going to want to see some clarity on these issues. And I think that's what's behind this correction and this volatility, again, this uncertainty we've seen creep back into the markets for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, Mike, as you mentioned, it's a very interesting soup indeed of all these different ingredients coming together. And it seems like almost every market is at a key inflection point, whether it's the dollar getting close to breaking out above that 94 resistance, whether it's the general markets, not just the S&P, but also the NASDAQ heavily weighted to tech, getting below their 50-day moving averages and getting closer to breaking down. The commodity sector is a key point. Everything seems to be at this tipping point. My question is, do you think that that some of this volatility is really not going to be resolved by the Fed as they continue to punt things down the road? Because when they see that this kind of market slowdown is happening while there's a slowdown in growth, they could easily punt at the November meeting. And what do you think that would do if they said, hey, we're going to wait till next year to figure this out and even punt the rate hikes from the end of 2022 into 2023? What kind of effect do you think that would have if they kicked the can down the road?
Yeah, I mean, I think this Fed, even more so, which is amazing to say, even more so than the Yellen Fed or the Bernanke Fed before it, doesn't want to be the bad guy at the table, doesn't want to be the proverbial punch bowl stealer at the party. And I think that if anything, you know, I think the Fed is probably eyeing some of what's going on here, some of this uncertainty, some of this volatility, and some of these markets that you mentioned being at key levels. If anything starts to really break, I think the Fed is gonna be extremely worried. I don't know if I'd use the word panic, but I think that if things do go from being sort of sideways and volatile and jumping around like an EKG to something where you're seeing significant breakdowns or breakouts, breakout to the upside in the dollar, breakdown significant to the downside in the S&P, you know, breakout in yields, breakdown in bond prices, all that. I think that if you do see those types of things happen, then yes, the Fed is probably going to react by saying, all right, hold on, you know, let's just, you know, regroup in 2022. And maybe that sets us up for a year-end rally. So there are a lot of variables floating around out there. I mean, you know, I think when it comes to practical advice for investors, I've tried to say, look, we're going to take some things off the table. I mean, we sold down some things in the Safe Money Report that had a mix of pretty decent gains and then one or two small hits. But it was like, let's just raise some cash. You know, let's do what a lot of other people are doing, because I think it's a smart risk management move just to see how this sorts out. You know, it's again, that's the first time after being pretty aggressive for a long time. I'm not outright selling the heck out of everything. I'm not moving a bunch of money to cash. I'm not, you know, hedging aggressively or trying to profit big time from downside moves. But I do think that, you know, it has made sense to kind of take some chips off the table and reassess and see what happens. Especially, I mean, we all know September and October especially are lousy months for the market. I mean, there's been significant pullbacks, corrections, obviously even a few crashes here and there. I don't think that, you know, the C word, the crash word is something I'm looking for. But I do think that, you know, you have that seasonality that's in the back of people's minds too. And again, it just makes investors, professional or individual investors, just kind of say, look, you know, it's been a great year. I think I'm just going to take some money off the table and just sort of see how things shake out.
Well, and that's a key thing to understand too, right, is that the markets at the peak for the S&P was already up about 20%, a little over 20% for the year already. And even after this pullback, still up around 16%. So maybe some traders just locking in some of their gains early. Mike, real quick here, I don't particularly think this matters for the market outside of the noise that it's making, but the debt ceiling debate, do you think it matters for the markets?
You know, I don't think beyond the short term. I mean, again, with the exception of 2011, when Obama and Boehner really let things go down to the wire and the Dow dropped a couple thousand points in the span of four or five or six or seven sessions, which, you know, that lesson, I think, really spooked Congress, spooked both the Republicans and the Democrats, and showed that if you try and push this gamesmanship too far to score political points, you know, you're going to get poor, your constituents are going to get poor, and you're going to have a hard time explaining why you did that to them, you know, around election time. So I think that that was an object lesson that ever since then, it really has drained the willingness of, again, either Republicans or Democrats to take a principled stand and say, I'm going to put my foot down and I'm not going to, you know, they'll bluster, they'll position for it and everything, but ultimately they're going to cave because they don't want to see that happen. And they've seen what happens when you do try and push things too far. You know, yes, that was 10 years ago, but I still think people have that, you know, it's recent enough that the memory and the understanding of what really happens if you let the gamesmanship get too close or too down to the wire, what's going to happen then? So I think that ultimately it's an issue for the next few days. It's been an issue for the last couple of weeks. But I think, you know, this is going to get resolved and it's not going to be an issue past October for sure.
Yeah, Mike, agreed. It ends up just being political theater and they always end up raising it. So it doesn't matter. Even if they shut down the government like they did that one time, they always end up raising it. They increase their credit card balance. So I'd like to move over to what we're seeing in energy, you know, and the commodity sector. Most of the commodity sector has been under pressure, as noted, from the stronger dollar and some of the China disruptions and growth. But there's one area that's really been leading the pack, and that's oil, gas, nat gas. It's been surging higher, and that puts inflationary pressures on the market. So what do you make of the move in oil? Is it getting overdone here? And how do you think that may impact the markets and just the general ability for consumers to go out and spend as they're getting taxed at the gas pump?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny when you think about it that there's been such a move to try and be more progressive, the sort of green tendencies in the political arena and in the economy or in the markets with so much ESG focus and so on. Everybody wants to have a cleaner economy, cleaner energy, you know, less fossil fuels and so on. In a twist of fate, what seems to be the strongest part of the market lately? It's all the companies that, you know, that drill for oil, produce gas and so on. And you're obviously seeing the impact on prices from some of this policy and from some of the demand and supply issues out there. So in any event, it creates issues for inflation. It does make the sector more investable after a long period where, you know, energy dramatically underperformed. So I think you definitely want to have some exposure there as an investor. For the Fed, I mean, let's be honest, they're going to just kind of make excuses for it, just like they've been doing for everything else. I mean, you know, oh, there's inflation that's partially caused by semiconductors. Well, that's transitory. Oh, there's inflation, you know, temporarily, quote unquote, caused by supply issues in the European gas market and, you know, demand issues elsewhere. Oh, that's all temporary, too. I mean, they're just going to keep calling everything temporary and transitory and refuse to address it and blame it on supply related issues versus demand and so on. So I don't think it changes the policy approach unless, you know, it really does have that sort of demand shock or economic growth shock impact. I mean, if anything, if you go back to sort of that 2008 period when oil went ballistic, got up to almost 150 U.S. dollars per barrel, you know, what was the Fed's reaction? That was in the midst of a unfolding housing crisis and, you know, real economic meltdown. So the Fed didn't worry about the inflationary impact. They said, oh, well, this is just another reason the economy is going to slow. You know, you can come up with any sort of verbal justification or thesis to support your position. If your position is that you never want to raise rates or you want to push it out as far as possible and you're worried about the markets getting upset, the Fed's just going to not focus on the inflationary impact. They're going to say, oh, people have to pay too much for gas. They're going to spend less money elsewhere. Just another reason we have to kick the can down the road. If anything, that's how I think they would react.
So, Mike, what do you take away from the general commodities complex? The CRB index does continue to rise, but you look outside of energy and uranium, which has been going up. I think that's a whole other story why that's going up. But all the other commodities seem fairly flat, or at least the metals. You look at precious metals, those are pretty flat. Base metals seem to have put in at least a top for most of this year. What do you think, Mike? What's this telling us about the overall environment here where it really is just energy moving higher?
You know, again, in sort of Wall Street, you know, jargon, I think a lot of things are simply a hold. I don't think there's a lot of reasons to sell precious metals here. I don't think there's a lot of reasons to sell base metals and miners aggressively or anything like that. You know, it is still kind of I'd love for it to be more exciting and tell you we're right on the cusp of something big, but it is really kind of this holding pattern environment. You know, what's going to happen in China? Are they going to stop building as many buildings, which means less concrete, less, you know, steel, less copper, and on, or are they going to just keep their growth engine going by throwing more money at that sector? Here in the U.S., what's going to happen, you know, with some of these things like interest rates? Is that kind of, are they going to spike? Is inflation going to be an issue? And therefore, slow sectors like housing and slow economic growth overall. You know, there's so many unanswered questions, and I think that that's why you're seeing those markets just continue to tread water, and in some cases, you know, lose value, but not crash or collapse or anything, but sort of bleed a little bit of value month in and month out and sort of a corrective pattern. And, you know, I keep looking for that catalyst that's going to break us out of this. Once I see something both technically and fundamentally to get more aggressive, then I will. But I, you know, again, I don't think it's a clarion call to sell everything, but it's also, you know, not something we're going to beat the table and or you know, beat the drums to buy everything either.
Well, Mike, just one more on commodities and inflation and how they all kind of tie together. Generally, in an inflationary periods, we'll see a weaker dollar where the commodities will move up. And we're also have seen quite a bit of wage pressure and labor, you know, there's a lot of labor participation issues where businesses are having a hard time staying staffed up. So they're having to increase raises and wages. And as a result, we usually see cost-pushed inflation, and that'll drag the commodities higher and the cost inputs for companies higher. But we're seeing a really weird environment where we're seeing slowing growth, rising wages, but the actual dollar strengthening into all this because of some of the fear. And so it's actually pressuring commodities. What do you think will move first, the chicken or the egg? Will it be that the dollar breaks out and starts a deflationary period? Or do you think the dollar will roll over and allow commodities to spread their wings a bit, especially in tandem with some of these proposed infrastructure bills? What do you make of this strange environment we're in?
I think that a lot of it just goes down to simple liquidity. I mean, you're going from having an environment where the Fed's, you know, is in a never-ending printing mode and a never-ending supportive mode, and you know, is trying to actively devalue the dollar as well as stimulate asset prices and so on. And, you know, that switch has been flipped in the last several weeks, last few months, and you can see that impact on the dollar. So I think what would be needed to sort of short-circuit this dollar rally and give commodities a broader-based boost, especially in things like precious metals, is for the Fed to do kind of what you mentioned earlier, see some of what's going on and decide to kick the can or change the narrative or just in general stop talking tough and be like, you know what, we don't want to create any chaos. We're going to just kind of go back to the sidelines and push this thing out, this tapering out even further. So it really, because you can even look at something like happened in the last few days, a couple of the central banks that have moved, the Bank of New Zealand, for example, raised interest rates, and what happened? The New Zealand dollar tanked against the U.S. dollar, which is the exact opposite of what the textbook tells you should happen. I think that's an illustration that it really boils down to the 800-pound gorilla being the U.S. Fed and what their outlook is. So if they get back into that you know, let's pump more liquidity in approach, then I think the dollar gives up on this rally, and you see more broad-based commodity inflation. But it's going to take something to trigger that Fed action. And I think that's why this volatility is very worth watching. If we do see some of those moves start to accelerate, you get fast moves in multiple markets, that's going to spook the Fed. They kick the can down the road, and then you're talking about higher gold, higher silver, and some more supportive action in commodities.
Well, that's the thing, right, is that the Fed can talk tough all they want, but we all know how quickly they can reverse course and pump some more money into the system. And remember, they haven't even really started unwinding, tapering, or even raising rates. So we are stuck still in this limbo, but undoubtedly the Fed is watching the markets most closely. Mike, just as we wrap up here, then, what are you watching most closely? What matters the most to your portfolio, to what you're sharing with subscribers, as we are now in the fourth quarter after what has been three strong quarters for the markets, but still a lot of question marks around the economic restart and even where inflation's going?
It's going to have to be whether, you know, how we market tack at these key levels, these key potential breakout, you know, reversal type levels. Investors for many, 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 many months have gotten sort of conditioned to buy every dip, you know, that we're going to hit those moving averages and bounce and then continue to rally to new highs, that we're going to hold those breakdown levels as opposed to, you know, plunge through them. So I'm just basically watching a lot of some of the same levels you've mentioned. And then depending on how the market behave, if we do show a convincing sort of reversal back to the upside, we do see a breakdown, then that's going to trigger either more selling on my part or some more aggressive buying for year-end rally. So I'm kind of trying to sit on my hands a little bit here and let the market tip its hand.
All right, Mike, we'll wrap it up here. Thanks for sharing your thoughts kind of broadly, encompassing what the markets have been doing and really what matters. Unfortunately, it is still a lot on the Fed, but one thing we do need to remember too is that the Fed, again, can switch course, but boy, oh boy, it's been a real focus on U.S. equities and more of a risk-on approach, it seems like. But recently, that's changed a little bit.
All I would say is one last parting word. Sometimes the best thing to do is just sit tight and sit on your hands. I mean, you know, don't force anything. And I think that's kind of the environment we're in here.
Absolutely. I think that does make the most sense right now. And It actually goes back to what Dana Lyons has been saying. This is a market that you try to hit singles, not home runs in. Mike, great chatting with you as always, buddy. We'll chat again in another couple of weeks. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you. Take care.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Mike Larson. In this segment, we are chatting with Mark Chandler, managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex, also the editor of the Mark to Market blog. I visit there every day, and that's where Mark really summarizes the key data points and key market moves or sector moves that he thinks need to be noted, a lot dealing as well with currencies. Mark, where I want to start here is a big picture look, kind of encompassing some of the data, especially the jobs data from Friday, and the rising oil price. Oil this week broke out to, I believe it was a 7-year high. So that plays into the whole inflation narrative for the, well, I guess overall focus here being, is inflation going to be transitory or not? Plus, we also did have that jobs data where the actual data, the hirings were very disappointing. They came in way shorter than estimates. However, hourly earnings, those rose more than estimates. So again, another chip in that more inflation category. What do you take away from these two main factors from this week when it comes to inflation and when it comes to the overall economy, please, Mark?
Yeah, sure. I think the most important takeaway is that the Federal Reserve is still on track to reduce its bond buying starting next month. Market also is not persuaded by the weakness in the jobs data, the job creation data, to pull back from its aggressiveness in pricing in more than one Fed rate hike by September next year, much earlier than the Federal Reserve has admitted to. Remember, in June and the September dot plots, only about half the Fed officials thought of a rate hike next year would be appropriate. The market's saying it's a done deal plus more.
Well, hey, Mark, one of the questions I have around this then is, with the Feds admitting that the inflation has been a little bit stickier and it has been a little frustrating to them, a lot of that has been written off as, you know, just supply chain interruptions and year-over-year base effect. But we are seeing it sticking in things like the energy sector that Corey mentioned. We are seeing inflation sticking around in some of the base metals and some of the agricultural products. But when we see wages increasing, like we did in that jobs report, and we see that wage pressure, when you have cost inputs going higher and you have wages going higher, it typically leads to cost push inflation. Do you think that may give the Fed a moment of pause to kick the can down the road and not taper like they say they're going to do in November? Or do you think they'll stick to it and stick to their knitting?
Yeah, I think that the Fed has little choice right now but to taper. Powell has acknowledged that even before today's data, that many of his colleagues thought that the conditions for tapering already are in place. I think that, you know, there's some elements of the today's report that I think that aren't as weak as one might suspect. For example, you know, the jobs data is really a product of two surveys, an establishment survey, that's what gave us that non-farm payroll number, and then a household survey. And that household survey that we get the unemployment rate. But in that household survey, very interesting, it showed that over 500,000 people that they were working more than the previous month. So there does seem to be some distortions there. And we know that the headline number, so low, 194,000, lowest number for this year. It's partly skewed by a problem that we're having with the hiring back at schools. Typically, U.S. local governments, state governments hire educators, teachers in September. And because they hired fewer this year, the seasonal adjustment really distorts it to the downside. Remember what happened, too. The August number, which we complained about, was so low at 235,000. That was revised up to 366,000. And typically the revisions point in the direction of the underlying trend. But it does seem to me true what you say, that you know we did see that hourly earnings rise 0.6%. Kind of interesting, because in August, the 0.6% was revised down to 0.4%. Two things are happening, it seems like, within the labor market. One is there does seem to be a genuine increase in wages. Secondly, there's also a change in the composition. So if people, say, my peers, hold on to their jobs during COVID, and people who are facing customers, fast food restaurants, hospitality industry, they lose their jobs, and then to get them, so it affects like what the average hourly earnings are. I would say there's an element of the report that's overlooked as we talk about the price component and the jobs created. There's a, it also counts, of course, is how long we're working. And there, the average work week jumped 0.2 hours. It doesn't sound like much, 0.2 hours, 12 minutes. But when you have 100 million people working, that 12 minutes turns into that's worth a lot of new jobs in terms of output. So I would say that even though the headline numbers were weak, you should still be seeing strong output numbers. And that really is an issue when we talk about, when you think about wages and labor costs. Because remember, wages are only about half of what your labor costs truly are when you put in the benefits and the other things that employers have to provide. And so you'd say, well, higher wages or higher labor costs turn into squeezing profit margins. But there's a piece of the puzzle that we forget then, and that's productivity. And so in the U.S., the way economists call both measures together is unit labor costs. Unit labor costs are very tame in the U.S. through the first half of the year. We don't have Q3 data yet, but it's remarkable that what the higher wages or the higher labor costs are being blunted by improved productivity. Because think about it. We have, say, roughly 5 million people, 6 million people fewer working now than we're working in 2019. And yet our output is higher. That productivity is why I think that some of the inflation fears are being exaggerated.
Well, Mark, I know we had a discussion about this off mic a little bit, but when I look at it through the lens of rising wages, and yes, it crimps the margins on businesses, but they always have a solution to that, and that's to raise prices. And so I would see that as still as slightly inflationary. We look at the fuel prices with oil up near $80, natural gas has almost doubled. And if we have a cold winter, that's only going to get worse. And you're seeing some of this inflation stick around. But there's a lot of articles I read every day talking about the growth slowing and they expect GDP to start slowing. So to me, it seems like a stagflationary environment is setting up. But you disagree with that. So walk us through how you see it in this kind of environment that we're in.
Sure. First thing I'd say is the thing about energy. Energy is a special thing because it goes into almost everything we have. You think about how farmers, modern farmers, Western farmers are growing crops. They use a lot of petrochemicals and different products, energy, carbon products for both pesticide and fertilizer. So when we think about food, it's very energy intensive, not only for the tractors and the gasoline and all that other stuff that we're familiar with, but also for the fertilizer and the pesticides. So the idea is that energy, price of carbon is in everything we have. And rather than being inflationary, I want to suggest to you is that higher oil prices are really the opposite. They are a tax on consumption because exactly what you're saying, Chad, businesses will try to pass those costs on. And what do higher prices mean? It's going to mean less demand. And that's really my point, is that the last three business downturns in the U.S. took place after oil prices have doubled. What a lot of people with gray hair will remember is that in 2008, oil prices were around $160 a barrel. Europeans, not the Americans, the Europeans thought this was inflationary, along the lines you were suggesting. And the ECB hiked rates not once, but twice. in 2008. Of course, we all know what happened in 2009, 2010, the deepest economic downturn up to that point since the Great Depression. Higher oil prices are a negative shock on the economy. It's a tax that's going to slow the economy down, even if in the short run, it filters into measured inflation, which is also why a lot of central banks, they target headline inflation. They do pay special attention to the core rate. And the reason that the core rate is important is not because energy and food are volatile. The core rate is important because over time, we have found that the headline rate converges to the core rate, not the core rate going to the headline rate. You want to have a guess on where inflation is going to be a year from now. Look at the core rate rather than the current headline rate. And the idea of stagnation, of course the economy is going to slow down. I mean, in the second quarter of this year, the U.S. economy grew 6.7%. Of course it's going to slow down. We're losing fiscal support. Some of the pent-up demand has been exhausted. But what are we talking about? We're still talking about above 4% growth through first quarter of next year. After that, still talking about above 2.5% growth the remainder of 2022. So I don't think that 2.5 to 3% growth, it's slow. It's slow, but it's not stagnation. It's basically back to where we were pre-pandemic. So I want to take the, I know that it's important that we have these frameworks to understand these developments. But I just think the stagflation scenario is misleading, partly because the stagnation part's not being delivered, at least not in the next year. And the inflation is still, I'm just not convinced that the magnitude of CPI, how much it can rise, says anything about the duration. When you look at, for me, when I look at some of the numbers, what I'm trying to do then is trying to parse the data and try to see the pace of change. Sort of like, you know, that ball that we throw against the wall, when it hits that wall, that at some point the ball is actually not moving. And I'm looking for those kind of inflection points in the movement in the market and in movement of inflation. And it turns out that when you annualize different periods, you can see how the pace of inflation is already slowing. It's hard to see it when you just look at the headline numbers and the year-over-year pace. But when you look at when you try to begin annualizing and seeing where we're going, I think it's clear that it's slowing. And you know, next week we get the U.S. CPI. And for the last 3 months or so, it's been 5.3 to 5.4%. That is to say, it's high, elevated. And I think, Chad, to your point, that it's higher than the Federal Reserve had initially anticipated. I do think, too, even though they haven't come out, I think it clearly said that it's lasting longer than they thought. I think that seems to be clear in their signals that they had thought it could have been peaking later this year, and now they've pushed it out into next year. But even there, I think that we'll get the CPI next week, and I think they were still looking at broad stability at these elevated levels.
So then, Mark, in summary then, for investors looking at these markets, which have maybe put in a top, they're at least moving sideways now, and also taking into account this rising dollar, especially this week, the dollar really started to move to the upside. What matters for investors? What are you being aggressive right now? Is it now time for caution? What do you think matters for all those wondering what they should do with their money?
Yeah, I think that once again, we've seen this. We had this nice, I don't know, calling it nice, but we had a pullback in some of the equity indices. And I think that, you know, we gapped higher yesterday in the S&P 500. We're holding above that gap before the weekend. I want to watch what happens there. I think we're sort of indecisive. I think we're at the crossroads now, whether this correction continues to the downside under the weight of higher interest rates and the weight of, you know, the U.S. just kicked the can down the road till early December for the fiscal cap. We're dealing with a lot of, I think, as Chad was mentioning, with the higher oil. So I think that there's a lot of concerns here, and I think that general area in the S&P 500, call it 4,400, is a real key area. If we go down and fill the gap, a different story. But I that's why I think that we'll be watching next week. We do have a lot of economic data besides the CPI. We're also going to get the retail sales report. And so I think that the next week, I think, will be decisive.
All right, Mark, great chatting with you as always, buddy. Thanks for taking kind of a bigger picture look at what all this data means for inflation or stagflation. That's a big debate that's going on right now. Mark, thanks again for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. And everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back to wrap up the weekend edition.
Thanks. Good luck to everybody.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Cortland Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. We're going to be focusing a bit more on precious metal stocks and some of the maybe nuanced opportunities that we are seeing in these stocks. We are chatting with Jayant Bhandari, private investor and consultant to a lot of well-known large investors in the resource space. Now, Jayant, we talked to you a lot about different stocks. You drive the whole way down into some of the even smaller resource stocks when it comes to finding opportunities, either dislocations in value or also arbitrage opportunities. That's where we're going to start here. You've outlined a number of arbitrage opportunities for us before, and just to bring people up to date, an arbitrage opportunity is where some sort of a transaction has come. So a takeover is announced, but the takeover price, especially when it's a share-for-share transaction, is not connecting to what the acquirer's share price is. So you can skim off 5, 10, even 20% on some of these transactions, but you do need to be nimble with your trades. Jayant, let's start off with this arbitrage opportunity that you are seeing right now. Please take us through it.
So, Corey, a company called Gold Resource, the ticker is G-O-R-O in the U.S., is merging with a company called Aquila Resources, and the ticker of Aquila is A-Q-A. A-Q-A trades in Canada. And what's going to happen is that this merger is expected to be completed in about 5 weeks' time. GORO is trading at about $1.60. Each shareholder of Aquila Resources will get 0.0399 share of GORO, which means that the value that Aquila shareholder will get for each share of Aquila is about 8 cents Canadian. So what I said was that you have to multiply the share price of GORO with 0.0399 and then the conversion rate from US to Canada, and that gives you about 8 cents. Now you can today get Aquila for 7 cents. That gives you a 14% arbitrage upside. For a lot of people, 14% upside over a period of 5 months is probably not very sexy enough. But what they have to do is to annualize that upside to see how much upside it offers you on annualized basis, which means that were you to roll this money into similar arbitrages going forward for a year, how much money you would be able to make. You would end up with 250% of the money that you invest at 7 cent today in Aquila Resources. As I have always talked with you in the past, when I do any arbitrage calculation, I then want to know whether the underpinning merged entity will have value as well or not. So often, there is not much value in the merged entity, and then I abstain from investing in those companies. What's happening with Gold Resource is that Gold Resource has a new management. I met the management at the Denver Gold Show in Colorado Springs last month, and I came out reasonably pleased with the management. I think they are a very professional group of people. However, I did my calculations on the underpinning value of GORO, and I think GORO is a bit expensive. Now, I know a lot of people like to invest in silver companies anyway, and they might want to overpay for it. I don't like doing it. So my strategy is that given the fact that the merged entity, in my view, will be expensive, what I'm doing is that I'm buying Aquila Resources at 7 cents, and I'm short selling Gold Resource at $1.65. which gives me about 15 to 16% arbitrage upside, and it books the upside for me. Now, I have to pay borrow fee for about 4 or 5 weeks, which I'm happy to pay. That might undercut my arbitrage upside by, let's say, 1 or 2 or 3%. But I'm very happy to make about 12 to 13% upside and book that upside. Now, the only risk in this that will be left for me is that the merger might not go through. And I have talked with people about it. I have looked at who owns the two different companies, and I am reasonably sure that the merger will go ahead. So I'm taking a very safe, very low risk for booking what is going to likely provide me 150% annualized upside.
Giant, I find this topic to be very interesting. And yes, you are kind of our arbitrage guru here on the site. So I always like getting your take on these. But two questions I have out of this. One is, when you're looking at these arbitrage opportunities, and you do like the scenario where the merged company may be a 1+1=3 scenario, do you hang on to the stock in that scenario? And then and then the second question would be, do you think that in this particular one that you're mentioning, that Gold Resource Corp may have a higher valuation still because previous to this merger that they're doing, they just did a spin out of their Nevada assets into Fortitude Gold. And I think they're still carrying a heavier weighting from when they actually had all those Nevada assets wrapped up with them. So now they've spun out a company and they're merging another one. So I think it's interesting you're shorting this one. Do you think that's why Goro Gold Resource has that higher valuation right now? And then if it wasn't this scenario, if it was just a generic scenario, would you sometimes hang on to the merged entity?
Well, of course, when I do a valuation of the underpinning assets of a merged entity, and if I think the upside that that company offers me is more than just the arbitrage upside, I hang on to it. I can hang on to it for another 2 or 3 years. I actually own several companies which I got invested into because of arbitrage opportunities. And then I carried on investing in those companies because I started to see upsides, inherent upsides in those companies. So yes, I hold on to such companies, but that's not going to happen with Goro. And the reason, as I said, is that I think it's a rather expensive company in my view. Their yearly profit, in my view, is about is less than 10 cents a year American. And it's trading at about $1.60 American. For me, that's like P by E of about 16. And I don't like it. I don't like that kind of overvaluation that I see, particularly when I know that the scope to expand the project is probably not very good. So I want to short sell Goro for now. If my view changes about Goro and Goro goes up, I might actually buy it at a higher price. But my buying price must offer me upside on inherent valuation basis.
Absolutely. I think all investors need to consider that when investing in any stock, even outside of an arbitrage opportunity. What about any other stocks, Giant, that have caught your eyes maybe at some of the recent conferences you were at, please?
So I met Riverside Resources, says John Mark at Beaver Creek Show, and I talk with him quite often. This is a company I have owned for a very long time. I quite like John Mark. I like his team. And of course, the company hasn't given a huge amount of returns to its shareholders, although they did spin out one company early this year to the shareholders, which might have made money for some shareholders. But this is an interesting company. It's a project generation company, and you really have to invest in such companies and forget about them, because when they hit something good, you will have an upside. Otherwise, you just sit through those companies. Now, Riverside is trading at 13 cents. The market capitalization is less than $10 million, and they have more than $5 million in cash. And this is an interesting thing with Riverside Resources. They have a lot of cash and they have raised a minimal amount of money over the last many years, which means that the brokers are not interested in the company. The company doesn't get promoted by salesmen at brokers. Now, Riverside has hence enterprise value of only $5 million. And they have a very interesting agreement with BHP. BHP is going to spend about $6.5 million over the next 1 or 2 years drilling a couple of projects with Riverside. And Riverside gets to keep 10% of that money as management fees, which also means that if you look at the profit and loss account of Riverside Resources, many times there is actually no G&A expense of Riverside overall, because the expenses that they do comes back to them as revenue. So that's an interesting thing about it. Now, they not only get 10% fee, they also get to retain 20% of projects that they work on with BHP. And of course, as often happens, BHP will not be interested in smaller projects, in which case those smaller projects stay on with Riverside for free, 100%. So from my perspective is that enterprise value is $5 million, management is are a bunch of people I like. They have an interesting agreement with BHP, which gives me a good underpinning financial valuation of what's going into the ground. And they have a lot of projects in the US, Canada, and Mexico, which might provide me an upside. What I like about John Mark is that he regularly churns through projects. He does not continue to hold on to projects that have come to be proven as useless. So that's something I like about generative companies. But again, you don't know when this share price will go up. My guess is it should go up by 30 to 50% anyway for traders who are listening to this. But I prefer to just buy and hold this. What happened recently is that one of the major shareholders dumped his position of Riverside. For whatever reason, he wanted to sell it. He's out of it. But I continue to like Riverside, particularly at 13 cents.
Well, Giant, this brings up an interesting topic on the prospect generator model itself. So when you're investing in prospect generators, yes, their G&A is very low because the partner companies are putting forth most of the money to drill and explore. They're the companies that have the teams doing all the on-the-ground work. And so the prospect generator has the benefit of somebody else spending money on their projects. But they also don't get as much upside if there is a discovery. So how do you like to play these companies? Because they can sit dormant for a while, and if there is a big discovery, some of them may decide, hey, you know, if they make the discovery themselves, they'll keep that project. But then if a partner project has a big discovery on it, they will get a little love. But is your goal with these to see them eventually turn these percentages, like this 10% percentage they'd have with BHP, turn that into a royalty of some sort? Or do you like it where they just keep a stake in a number of projects and just have a diversified basket?
So, Shad, what I do is to do valuation of these companies at any point of time, at any specific time. Now, I am actually not a big fan of prospect generation companies. I think the whole thing, the propaganda, what I call propaganda, that these companies use other people's money is actually mathematically erroneous, as you rightly, Shad, explained in just what you said. Because not, of course, other people spend the money, but they also get to keep most of the projects. So these prospect generation companies are not necessarily living off other people's money. Now, what I do is that I only rarely, very rarely invest in prospect generation companies, and Riverside has been one of my holdings. And as I just explained to you right now, that the valuation is so attractive to me right now. I think this 13 cent stock should go up by 30 to 50% in a normal market, and I hope to see that over the next few weeks. So just for trading purposes, it looks attractive to me. But again, the downside support is so good that I don't see a loss coming my way right now. And one thing that I learned in 2011 was to protect my capital, and I see that protection in Riverside Resources. Now, you said the right thing. What do I want to see them doing? Converting in these their ownership into royalties or something else? I don't think much about it because I leave that to the management, because management is supposed to know better about negotiations on those projects, and they are supposed to know better about the projects themselves than I do. So I don't get involved in those things, don't want to worry much about it, as long as I trust the management and as long as I see underpinning value and a good downside support. And that's how I go about investing in these companies. Now, just to conclude, one of my big win was Arwix Ventures, which had this Long Canyon project, and they merged with finally, and the project ended up with Newmont. That made us a lot of money, and we ended up investing in that company on the simple fact that the underpinning value was so good, even if they had a minimal ownership on the project, that we were very happy to invest in it. So we just do valuation based on what they own and whether that valuation gives us enough upside based on the share price that's available at that point of time.
Thanks for your insights on Riverside there, Jayan. I had the company on mostly through last year, walking through some of these new agreements that they had signed and a number of their other projects. They are well diversified, but yeah, for project generators or prospect generators, really comes down to somebody making a discovery and those companies building up royalty portfolios and then turning into royalty companies from some of their internal projects that they generated. So hopefully they will find something in the drill program and hopefully that turns into a mine for that company. But they have done a good job of keeping their share structure very tight. Jayan, just as a final concluding comment here, how aggressive are you being right now with your investments? Clearly, this market continues to be under pressure. We have seen some life day to day in these stocks, but overall, unfortunately, it has very much been a two steps back, one step forward for a lot of these stocks as they continue to drift. And now we are seeing some very cheap valuations, some companies trading for cash in the bank. How aggressive are you right now?
This is the time I'm the most aggressive. This is when I have a lot of opportunities and very little cash. I'm using up my cash very rapidly. And in fact, I just agreed to give a lot of my cash to a company that is raising money right now. So I will have used up every single penny that I have for investment purposes in my portfolio.
Okay. Well, that is saying something there, Jayan, because I know how defensive you can be when you think valuations are too high. And now clearly valuations have very much been washed out. Jayan, great having you on the show. Everybody, thank you for tuning in on this weekend show. Please go back throughout the week, listen to those daily editorials, and please keep up to date with Shad and I through email, flex@kereport.com and shad@kereport.com. Jayan, everyone else, I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you very much.